Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. We welcome you to this podcast for March 28, 2024. We are recording this week from the Cryptozoology Department here at the Georgia Historical Society on the 15th floor of the Jepson House, overlooking beautiful Forsyth Park in downtown Savannah. What, you may ask, is cryptozoology? Well, I'm glad you asked. Cryptozoology is a pseudoscience and subculture that searches for and studies unknown, legendary, or extinct animals or creatures whose existence is disputed or unsubstantiated. We're talking this week about two things that are near and dear to my heart. I wouldn't say that I'm passionate about one of them, the first, but I am deeply interested in both. That is Bigfoot and baseball. I had occasion recently to read a brand new book out on Bigfoot. It is entitled The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster. Written by John O'Connor, published by Source Books in 2024. And, usually when I talk about a book on this podcast, I invite the author. The truth is, I couldn't figure out how to get a hold of John O'Connor. His contact information is not readily available. I did not want to go through his publisher. And it turns out that he probably does not make himself readily available because people who believe in Bigfoot believe fervently in Bigfoot and do not like to have their beliefs questioned, which Mr. O'Connor does in this book. He does not say that he doesn't believe. He is a skeptic. And so it's a fascinating book. There is no secret history. This is one of those titles, again, that's designed just to get your attention. There's no secret history of Bigfoot in this book. This is just simply the author who really travels around the United States, meeting with various people, various groups who either believe or don't believe or might believe in this legendary creature who supposedly roams the forests of North America. And he meets with these people, he talks with these people. Now, this book has been reviewed, that's how I found out about it, in most of the major publications in this country. It was reviewed by Carl Hoffman in the Washington Post on February 6th, and not a very favorable review. He didn't have a lot of nice things to say about it. In part, he says there's some great stuff here about, and I'm quoting, about myth and imagination and about the power and importance of wilderness and wildness to the human psyche. But he calls it a frustrating read. He says, and I'm quoting here again, this is a review in the Washington Post written by Carl Hoffman. The Bigfooters that John O'Connor hangs out with come across as overgrown adolescent nitwits desperate for fellowship and purpose, who seem to have lost the ability to parse truth from fiction, the real from the imagined, and seem incapable of metaphor. He says this is all of which is no fun. It gets tedious very quickly. I thought John O'Connor did a remarkably good job of being fair to people that he talked to. He even went out in the night on all-nighters with some of these groups who go out into the woods in hopes of seeing Bigfoot. I don't feel like I need to describe to you what Bigfoot is. I feel like at this point in 2024 in our culture, most people have probably heard about Bigfoot, have maybe watched a documentary or something that purports to be a documentary. Finding Bigfoot was an incredibly popular show on Animal Planet for many years. Bigfoot is, of course, a cryptid. Cryptids are animals that cryptozoologists believe may exist somewhere in the wild, but whose existence is disputed or unsubstantiated. Bigfoot is the most famous. The Loch Ness Monster, the Abominable Snowman are the other two of the trio. Of course, Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman, are related. And legends of this sort, of course, go far back, and not only in the human psyche, but here in North America, most indigenous cultures have some sort of myth or legend or folklore about a wild man, wild person of the woods. O'Connor talks about many of them. There are accounts from English missionaries, from explorers, going back into the 15th, 16th, 17th century of encounters they've had in the woods. Some indigenous cultures thought it was good luck to see what we would have called a Bigfoot. Others, not so much. It's obviously a controversial subject. Now, I've just always been interested in the subject of Bigfoot, in part for a reason that we'll get to in just a minute, because of a movie that came out in 1972 when I was not quite 8 years old that I went to see with my friend Jeff G. I recall that Jeff and I went to see this movie. I may be wrong about that, but I think it was Jeff. Jeff, if you're listening, you can let me know if this is true. The movie was called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which I'll get to in a minute. And according to O'Connor, and he talks about this a little bit, that movie had a tremendous influence on a whole generation of people who became fascinated with Bigfoot. For many years, I fervently believed that there was such a thing as Bigfoot. Maybe I wanted to believe it, like a lot of these people. O'Connor is quite fair about the fact that many of these people are well-meaning. They're responsible adult citizens, most of them. And they don't know, but they want to understand. Some of them have are involved in this because they have seen something. They've been out in the woods on a hike. They've been camping. They have been in remote areas. They've been driving down a road at night, whatever, and have seen something. They don't know what it is. They don't always believe it's Bigfoot, but they don't know what it is. Usually it was on two legs. Usually it was big. Sometimes it was dark. I mean, literally, it was dark outside. The creature itself is usually always dark. Sometimes it has red, brownish hair. And the history of this thing is, fairly interesting in terms of it got its name Bigfoot, I think, in 1958 when a remote crew in California, a logging crew that were clearing some roads, arrived one morning at their job site and they found these incredible footprints near their bulldozers. And the creature was dubbed Bigfoot. Of course, it's been known by all kinds of names. What is really interesting to me about all of this is that whatever you call it, these kinds of legends, some of them have very regional takes. You can pull this thread, and now, of course, with the internet, this has taken on a whole new life of its own. There are sites dedicated to reporting Bigfoot sightings. There are sites that supposedly investigate these things. The word cryptozoology, by the way, John O'Connor points out, first appeared in a 1961 book by Ivan T. Sanderson, who was himself a Bigfoot believer, called Abominable Snowmen: Legend Come to Life. So, this is not a branch of science that I think has a lot of, I don't want to say it doesn't have a lot of credibility, but other scientists do not believe people who study cryptozoology have, has a lot of credibility. So, who are these cryptids? Who are these things that are out there? What are they? Bigfoot, of course, is the most famous, but there are many others. Some of them have regional aspects to them. The Jersey Devil is very famous. I will actually say, if you were a fan of the TV show The X-Files, you know that there were two types of shows on that series, which I loved and watched in its entirety when it was on. It, of course, had the shows about the X-Files conspiracy UFO business. And then it had the Monster of the Week, where it would just sort of go off and somebody had seen a monster of some kind somewhere in the United States, and Scully and Mulder would be sent out from, Washington, D.C. to go investigate. And this happened on a lot of different episodes. In my mind, those are some of the most memorable, if not scary, episodes. We all know, by the way, the scariest X-Files episode ever was the one called Home. Season 4, Episode 2 came out in October of 1996 and scared the crap out of everybody. If you haven't seen that episode, I warn you, it is highly disturbing, but watch it. It's so well done. There's so many aspects of it that bear talking about. Maybe one day I'll do a whole podcast on that episode alone. But I'm not going to talk about that today. But X-Files did a lot of other episodes about things that we would call cryptids. Strangely enough, it never did one. Well, not so strangely. It never did one about Bigfoot. Maybe it was just too obvious, but it did do one called Quagmire, Season 3, Episode 22, about a Loch Ness-type creature named Big Blue that actually took place in a fictional Georgia, North Georgia community called Milliken, Georgia, in a North Georgia lake. Very well done. There was an episode about the Chupacabra, of course, which is I think that means it's Spanish for like blood goat bloodsucker or something like that, a mythical bloodsucking vampire-like beast, Season 4, Episode 11. But in the very first season, in episode 5, they did one called the Jersey Devil, which again is kind of a Bigfoot-like mysterious creature that supposedly lives in the wilds of New Jersey. There have been sightings on and off probably for the last 75 years. That episode was particularly well done. There was an episode, wasn't really a cryptid, but a little bit. Season 5, episode 4, Detour, was one which there are some strange things going on in Florida. And it actually referenced the Mothman, which, of course, is a cryptid that was sighted in West Virginia, 1966 and 67. If you are not familiar with that, all of these things, of course, nowadays, you can research for yourself on the internet. They are all there. Those are some of the X-Files episodes that I would recommend, that if you're interested in this subject at all, and there are many other episodes like this where there's some sort of a creature out there, it might be in a sewer, it might be in a swamp. The best ones were, of course, when there was something out in the woods that they didn't know about. But the Bigfoot legend takes different shape in different places. As I mentioned, the Jersey Devil, there's also the Skunk Ape. This is in Florida. This is kind of Florida's version of Bigfoot, and according to Wikipedia, and what could be wrong there, out of 67 counties in Florida, there have been skunk ape sightings in like 47 of 68 counties. I think I said 67. I meant six. I think there's 68. So the skunk ape has been sighted, as you can imagine, in rural areas. For the most part, in 1942, a man in Suwannee County reported seeing a creature rushing out from the brush line of the trees while he was driving down an isolated road. He said it grabbed onto his vehicle and beat on the running board, which cars in 1942 had, and his door for about half a mile before it left him alone. My favorite of the skunk ape legends is in Putnam County, Florida, in the small community of Bardin, B-A-R-D-I-N, Bardin. Beginning in the 1940s, there were a number of alleged sightings of a creature that came to be known as the Bardin Booger, which is funny because growing up, we always referred to movies that were about these kinds of things as a booger movie, right? There's a booger outside that's going to get you, which is a very Southern term. But so the Bardin Booger was a skunk ape. And then in the 1960s, really after the Bigfoot mythology took off in the late 50s, early 60s, with sightings of supposedly large footprints, the number of sightings reported went up. There were a rash of sightings in central Florida around Alachua County, where Gainesville and the University of Florida are, and Marion County. In 1963, several members of a family encountered what they called an ape-like creature around their rural home, including one instance of it approaching a window to peer inside at night, which, let's be honest, that aspect of this, to me, is much more frightening than being out in the woods when you're sort of in his territory and you see a Bigfoot. But when they come walking up and just kind of peek in the windows, that's when it really gets frightening. I mean, make no mistake, if these things are for real, that's really scary stuff. Again, reports of the skunk ape were particularly common in the 1950s through the 1970s, and really up to the present day, these things are still out there. There are variations of the skunk ape. Sometimes they're not Bigfoot-like creatures. There's the Loveland frog. Now, if you don't know about this, and I'm sure you probably don't. By the way, you can, as I said, you can research any of this on the internet to your heart's delight. The Loveland frog, according to various legends, first sighted in Loveland, Ohio, by a businessman. And late at night, driving down the road, 1955, or a traveling salesman, whatever he was, some versions of the story. In the spring, maybe the month of May, 1955, he's heading out of a neighborhood. He spots three figures standing erect on their hind legs along the side of the road, 3 to 4 feet high, leathery skin, and frog faces. In other versions of the story, the creatures are spotted under or over a poorly lit bridge. and one held a wand over its head that fired a spray of sparks. A frog holding a wand spraying sparks. I don't know if there was alcohol involved in this sighting or not. This is the Loveland frog. It was sighted again, by the way, by two police officers in 1972. There's the Dover Demon. Now, this is really kind of, the Dover Demon was spotted in Dover, Massachusetts, which is a town about 15 miles southwest of downtown Boston, the nights of April 21st and 22nd in 1977. A bunch of teenagers saw what they described as an alien-like creature with tendril-like fingers and glowing eyes. This probably falls more in the realm of a UFO sighting than a Bigfoot sighting. But again, they gave it a local name. This is a very regional kind of thing. Similar to the encounter of also in 1955 called the Kelly Hopkinson encounter. You can look that up. A family that claimed to have been under siege in their farmhouse for several hours by several little alien-like creatures. They didn't describe them as little green men, but the press did later. So there are regional varieties of Bigfoot out there. There's the skunk ape. There is, as I mentioned, the Mothman. This was a winged, kind of a winged Bigfoot, almost, if you will, but a winged creature in West Virginia, 1966 and 67. You can read about that. I'm not really going to talk about it very much. The version that I heard growing up, and it wasn't really about Bigfoot, but it was really scary. My father's family was from Barrow County, which once upon a time was part of Jackson County. And when I was growing up, occasionally I would go down there, particularly in the summers, to spend the night with cousins or uncles or my grandparents. And they would tell the story of something called the Wog, W-O-G. This was a creature of undetermined shape, but this thing had a forked tongue that had tormented early settlers of Jackson County, apparently. It would come up to their log cabins in the night and might stick its forked tongue through the chinks in the logs, the gaps in the logs in the log cabin. You can imagine that to my seven-year-old mind, this had to have been real and was, it scared the crap out of me. I did not want to ever sleep near an open window, and the windows were always open in the summer there because nobody had air conditioning, so it was terrifying. Now, of course, with the internet, you can go on and you can search and look for the Wog, and there is stuff on there about it. It is described as a fearsome beast that is a black, that looks more like a black demonic dog than anything. Not at all like Bigfoot, but still something, you know, don't know if this comes out of any indigenous legend or if it is purely made up. One of the authors that I found on the internet cites it coming from a book written by a man named Wilson called The Early History of Jackson County, Georgia, that was published in 1914, and he writes about the Wog. That's probably where my relatives heard of it, but, you know, again, this is a cryptid, local jurisdiction, as so many of these things do. I have heard of a lizard man that was sort of at the Georgia-South Carolina border. You know, again, there's all kinds of things like this out there. We mentioned the Loveland Frog and the Dover Demon. Now, the movie that I mentioned, The Legend of Boggy Creek, was about something in Arkansas that, and I can't quite get the pronunciation of this little community. It's spelled F-O-U-L-K-E. I think it's Falk. Falk, Arkansas, the Falk Monster. So the Legend of Boggy Creek is it purports to be a documentary. I think it was called, it's a docudrama, but it came out in 1972 after reports of a Bigfoot-like creature terrorizing this small community. It's reportedly been seen since the 1940s. It was directed by Charles Pierce, who went to this community in Arkansas. He hired most of the people on his crew were local high school students. Some of the people in the community sort of appeared as themselves. There were some actors who appeared as other people, but it reenacted some of the things that people had reported as having witnessed. that one woman claimed is she was sleeping on her couch one night and this thing reached through a window and tried to grab her. It was chased off by her husband and his brother. They shot at it, but never found any blood, never found a body. We'll come back to that. Both of those are very important. This thing ran 87 minutes. I remember seeing the trailer for it in 1972. As I said, I went to go see it at the theater in Snellville, Georgia, and it scared the crap out of me, and I never doubted for a second that it was real. It was about this swamp creature that people kept seeing that looked too human to shoot. Hunters would run into it. They always felt like they might be committing murder if they shot at it because it always looked too human. Now, according to our author, John O'Connor, in his book on Bigfoot, and I will quote here, Boggy Creek is the pop cultural touchstone for Bigfooters, most of whom came of age in the late 60s and early 70s and recall seeing it at drive-ins or theaters when it first came out, or later in friends' rec rooms on pirated VHS tapes, and feeling strangely throttled by its gloominess. It certainly had that. It has a whole, as he points out, a fact versus fiction aura about it. You have people who are supposedly giving eyewitness accounts of how when they encountered it, always at twilight, maybe at night, maybe first thing in the morning when the light is never good, menacing people in remote country houses. There's a very famous and somewhat funny scene, and it was almost black humor in that it made everybody laugh, of a guy who was sitting on a toilet in one scene, and the creature reaches through to grab him. And that was in the trailer, so everybody knew it was coming. But it did have a profound impact on an entire generation of people who grew up sort of believing. And Bigfoot sightings, as you can imagine, you know, went through the roof all over the United States at that time. Bigfoot famously appeared in two episodes of the enormously famous $6 Million Man TV show in September 1976. On top of all this, of course, there are the grainy photographs. Nowadays, there are grainy video recordings that people do on their phone. But the Zapruder film of Bigfoot legend is, of course, what is known as the Patterson-Gimlin film, or better known as the Roger Patterson film, which was shot by Roger Patterson and his friend Bob Gimlin on Friday, October 20th, 1967. Now, they were alongside Bluff Creek, which is in a remote area of Northern California. Bluff Creek is a tributary of the Klamath River, about 25 logging road miles northwest of Orleans, California, in Del Norte County, on the Six Rivers National Forest. They were there with the express purpose of hoping to catch a glimpse of this creature who has always been sighted in Northern California. Roger Patterson at that time was about 34 years old. His friend Bob Gimlin was just a few years older. They were both on horseback, and as I said, they were near Bluff Creek. When they saw what they thought, they found out later by looking at this film, was a female Bigfoot who became known as Patty, got nicknamed as Patty. But they shot 59 and a half seconds of film. And this thing has been analyzed about as much as the Zapruder film has been. If you haven't seen it, it's readily available on YouTube or just about anywhere else. You can watch the unedited version. There have been stabilized versions where you can, the film is held motionless while Bigfoot walks across the screen. And it seems entirely believable, right? That they're, but it's on horseback. So at first the horse rears because this animal is there. It's hard to tell exactly how far away it is. We don't know now exactly how fast the footage was. Was it shot at 16 frames per second? Was it shot at 18 frames per second? One of the really cool things in this new book is the author goes along with some of the crew from Finding Bigfoot, and they go back to the exact site where Roger Patterson shot this film 60 some odd years ago. Now, for years, the site was lost. The exact location was lost because of regrowth of foliage, as you can imagine, in the stream bed itself, which had sort of been scoured out after a flood in 1964, but it was rediscovered in 2011. They go back to the place itself, and try to reenact exactly how big that creature was based on how far away Roger Patterson was. You can read all about it in the book. I'm not going to go through it here. But that film has been dissected by skeptics and believers since that Friday afternoon in October all those years ago, 57 years ago. I said 60. It's been 57 years. Will be this October. Roger Patterson died in 1972. Bob Gimlin is still alive. He will be 93 this year. He stands by what he says they saw. A lot of people have watched this film and declared it a hoax, that there's all kinds of things wrong with it, that it's probably a man in a gorilla suit. And this brings us, of course, to the problem with all of this is, and everybody who ever claims to believe in Bigfoot has to, and I don't claim to believe in it. I think I'm as skeptical as John O'Connor. And that is, after all these years and all these sightings, why has no one, first of all, ever put together, honest to goodness, real believable photography and or moving picture, motion picture footage, now video? There's high def cameras available that can be mounted on anything. There's absolutely no creature out in the wild that we have not photographed very well, even the most reclusive, like wolverines and all kinds of bears, as scientists have pointed out. Why don't we really have any definitive documentary evidence that these things exist? And moreover, why have we never found a body? There's been not been a single body. There's not a skeleton. There isn't any poop. There isn't any skin. There isn't any hair that hasn't. You would think you would find these bodies. We do find bodies of all kinds of other animals, sometimes decades later, bones and skulls of bears and deer. Never been a body. And as scientists have pointed out, and at the end of his book, O'Connor talks to some of the people involved in the National Park Service in talking about. In fact, he talked to a bear biologist, a grizzly bear biologist in Missoula, Montana. He called him and talked to him. He'd worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's grizzly bear recovery efforts for 36 years. And he talked to him and said, he said, I asked him if it was conceivable that an animal of Bigfoot's girth could survive undetected in the American West. No, he said, it's not possible for a large animal to exist in these landscapes and not be seen. Could they just really be good at eluding surveillance? He asked. No. There are lots of people in these landscapes and lots of ways to see these animals. Aircraft flights, automatic cameras, even rare animals like grizzlies or wolverines. We see them, he said. And even in places where they're really low density, they show up on cameras. So the fact that Bigfoot is never detected just doesn't make any sense. What it tells me is that they're not out there, that it's another fantasy. What about the bones and decomposed remains of bears? Were they as rare as some Bigfoot supporters contend? He says, no, they're quite common. People find grizzly bear skulls and bones, black bear skulls and bones, all kinds of bones all the time. Animal remains are found all the time. They don't dissolve and disappear. They don't bury their dead. And of course, they have to reproduce. This is the other thing. They covered a wide as area as Bigfoot people say that they cover. They have to reproduce across a wide area. It does beggar the imagination to believe that something that large, that big, some of them reported to be 8 feet tall and weighing 500 pounds, or if not much more than that, are out there and nobody has ever had any definitive proof of it. Which begs the question, then why does all this go on? Why do people still continue to see the skunk ape, continue to see Bigfoot, continue to believe that when something runs in front of their car on a dark night on two legs, and they can't explain it, what is it? And that's really at the heart of this book. What is it about these kinds of things? We live in a world where we think we know everything about the world now. There are very few surprises or secrets anymore. I'm not saying we understand everything in science, but you know, what is it about this? And there's a pull about the idea that there's something out there. There's something lurking in the woods. There's something that might come peep in the window, and we don't know what it is. That, to me, is fascinating. I think it fascinated John O'Connor, and that's why he wrote this book, and that's why people still believe that they see things like Bigfoot. I've been fascinated with this story going back about 50 years, and I enjoyed reading this book. I think if you're at all interested in this, you probably will too, whether you're a skeptic or a hardcore believer. I thought he did a good job of balancing those two things. The book, again, is called The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster. The author is John O'Connor. Publisher is Sourcebooks, 2024. You can order it any place that you find books. Let's turn now to the other part of this podcast about baseball. And I'm particularly talking about this because on Thursday, March 28th, the Atlanta Braves kick off the 2024 Major League Baseball season. Now, you will remember, if you're a long-suffering listener of this blog, and I know that you are, that just a few months ago, I did a podcast about what the heck happened to the Braves in the postseason. After winning 104 games last season, our season ended ingloriously in Philadelphia, as it did in 2022. For the last 2 years, the Braves have had a phenomenal baseball team that has won a lot of games. They do not seem to be able to get past the first round of the playoffs. Now, there was a Mark Bradley column in today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution entitled, Asking for a Friend, Should the Braves Try to Win a Bit Less? Meaning, we've won our division running away the last 2 years. If we win fewer games, might we be better off going in as a wild card and then playing immediately after the season ends and not having this long layoff, which has seemed to bedevil us for the last couple of years, having to wait nearly a week to play after the season ends. The Braves came into spring training this year. I've been following them, and they're with this mantra of, quote, World Series or bust expectations. I think that's a little silly. Everyone understands that the baseball season is 6 months long, but it's the games that happen after those 6 months that the Braves have had a problem with. When October gets here in 6.5 months and the Braves are hopefully playing there, how about we say a first round of the playoffs or bust? Let's get past the Philadelphia Phillies in the playoffs or some way to get past that first round to get into the National League Championship Series. That should be our goal. It seems silly to say World Series or bust because the Braves have proven repeatedly they can be a great team that can really perform at an unbelievable level across the entire 162-game season. And I mean pitching and offense. Last year, they put on an offensive show that we might not ever see again. And then again, we might see it this year. Who knows? But the idea that they've got to get to the World Series, how about we get past the Phillies in the first round? Let's set that as our goal. I understand setting the ceiling very high. That's good. But wow, it's been heartbreaking the last 2 years to watch a team that is so good for so long and is clearly better than the Phillies not be able to move past them in the first round. Now, our starting rotation looks even better than it did last year. Spencer Strider is going to start opening day in Philadelphia. By the way, we play those hated Phillies in their ballpark. On Thursday, March 28th, 3:05 p.m., first pitch. Spencer Strider, who Justin Toscano of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is predicting is going to win the Cy Young Award this year. He thinks it's either going to be Spencer Strider or Max Fried. I hope it's either or both. That means we've had a great season. Spencer Strider, Max Fried, our new pitcher, Chris Sale, who comes over from the Boston Red Sox, is slotted in third. Charlie Morton is our fourth starter, and Reynaldo Lopez will come out of spring training as our fifth starter. He is replacing Bryce Elder, who will start this year, as he did last year in the minor leagues. At some point, I'm sure he'll get called up, probably sooner rather than later. Lopez might be better in the bullpen. He is a really lights-out late innings pitcher, but right now they think he can serve the team better as the fifth starter, who doesn't pitch all the time. So he may see some action in the bullpen. But those are our five starting pitchers. Our projected starting lineup is fearsome. If Chris Sale can stay healthy, he hasn't the last 2 years. Charlie Morton turned 40, which in baseball years is like me being 85 years old. But so far, so good. He's had a good spring. They just probably need to manage his innings a little going into October. Our bullpen looks good on paper. Raisel Iglesias is our closer. AJ Minter is coming back. He can be good or he can be terrible on any given day. Early last season, I referred to him repeatedly as AJ Serve Him Up because he was repeatedly coming in and giving up the long ball. Pierce Johnson is back. Joe Jimenez, Aaron Bummer, who we acquired from the Chicago White Sox. Tyler Matzek is back from Tommy John surgery. He missed all of last year and a good bit of 2022, but you will remember his heroics in the postseason in 2021 when we went all the way and won the World Series. Dylan Lee and Jackson Stevens is probably going to eat a lot of long innings. Our bullpen is really good and could get better. And by the way, if those starters at any point don't do well, A.J. Smith-Shawver is in the minors. I mentioned Bryce Elder. And of course, there's a host of other people who pitched last year who we could also probably call upon to fill in. So this is probably going to be fluid through the year, but that's what we're coming out of spring training with. Our catchers, of course, Sean Murphy and Travis d'Arnaud. Our infielders, who play almost every game, Matt Olson at first, Austin Riley at third, Ozzy Albies at second, Orlando Arcia is shortstop, and Luis Guillorme will be the one who spells probably Ozzy and Orlando between second and shortstop. Outfielders, wow. Ronald Acuna Jr. will be back, of course. Michael Harris II, who has only played one full season in the majors. This will be his second full season. He played a partial season in 2022. They expect him to have a breakout year. Left field will be a platoon. Jared Kelenic, who we picked up. Kelenic, I think, is how it's pronounced. We picked him up from the Seattle Mariners. He was one of the top prospects in baseball. They expect if he can get his swing back, he will return to form. He hasn't had a great spring, but they think he'll break out. He will platoon with our old friend Adam Duvall, who was on that championship team. Duvall, I think, will play against right-handers. Kind of the role that our friend Kevin, I'm drawing a blank now, played last year. A fella came off the bench and terrific, gave a veteran presence. And then Forrest Wall, who spent a lot of years in the minors, called up last year, terrific speed. He will get a chance to play some in the outfield as well. Not much. It should be Acuna, Harris, and Kelenic almost every day. Adam Duvall will get some playing time as well. Our DH, who can also play outfield some and perhaps some first base, is Marcell Ozuna again. So our projected opening day lineup, right fielder Acuna will lead off. Albies will hit second. Riley will hit third. Matt Olson cleanup. Ozuna fifth. Harris, Murphy, and of course Arcia. So, and Kelenic. Should be a great team and a great season. It should be fun to watch them. Anything is possible on opening day. The team to beat seems to be the Los Angeles Dodgers because they signed Shohei Ohtani to an outrageous $900 gazillion contract in the offseason, much of which is deferred. But, you know, he was with the Angels for how many years, and they didn't win bupkis with him there. I don't think, you know, the Dodgers, like the Braves, underperformed last year when it got to the playoffs, as did the Orioles. But nevertheless, the Dodgers always seem to be the team to beat, and then they are beaten. So I feel like the Braves have more depth on their bench, and I like our starting pitchers. So buckle up, folks. It's going to be another fun summer. If you like baseball, we'll see in October where it all goes. I am really hoping that next October I do not have to do a podcast about what the heck happened to the Braves. Let's hope. There's always hope in baseball, right? The hardest working producer and engineer in show business, the producer of this show, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS human pyramid building team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our director of communications and staff pediatrician is Keith Pinstripe Strigero. The GHS director of historical marker lunatics is Brianna, let it go straight to voicemail, James. The captain of the GHS Italian wine tasting team is Rebecca Bierstein Bertina. Our GHS bouncer is Greg the Enforcer Jerkin. The director of the GHS Civil War Beard Division is Nate Brickwall Jackson Peterson. Our Off the Eaten Path fact checker is Ella Fino. Our accounts payable administrator is Imelda Checks. The GHS opera critic is Barbara Seville. The Off the Eaten Path staff bookshelf maker is L. Ron Cubbard. Our director of employee loyalty is Upton Leftis. Our staff layoff specialist is Harry Verderci, assisted by layoff counselor Oscar LaVista. Our Off the Eaten Path HR director is Stella Payne Diaz, assisted by our deputy HR director, Royal Payne Diaz. The official Off the Eaten Path dry cleaner is Preston Creases. The GHS Russian intern this year is Igor Beaver. The Off the Eaten Path Elvis impersonator is Amal Shook Up. Our staff director of Three Stooges Studies is Lee Iapoca. Dr. Todd Gross's personal eBay specialist is Selma Junkoff. And our Off the Eaten Path martini mixer, thank you very much, is Olive Twist. You can find our podcast anywhere you can find podcasts. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at our newly designed website. Check it out, georgiahistory.com, and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Eaten Path on Facebook as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out videos, dispatches from Off the Eaten Path, my blog, and similar disputed or unsubstantiated podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.